Talking History with Patrick Gagan. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchtereuen, Argus.
Odysseus. Don't you remember?
Thunder.
I remember a wife, a son, home.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're exploring one of the foundational texts of Western civilization, the Odyssey, and we'll be finding out why it continues to enthrall and inspire nearly 3,000 years later. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com and we'd love to hear from you. Nearly 3,000 years after it was first composed, Homer's epic continues to shape literature, cinema and popular culture. It's a story of monsters and magic, of gods and vengeance, and also of family, identity, exile and the longing to return home. This summer, Christopher Nolan brings the Odyssey to the big screen, and interest in the ancient poem has never been greater. And so in tonight's show, we want to explore the history of this remarkable epic. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Alexandra Madewa is in the Department of Classics at Trinity College Dublin and is a former Irish Research Council, now Research Ireland postdoctoral fellow there. She's the author of The Argonautica by Orpheus, Writing Pre-Homeric Poetry in Late Antiquity. Dr. Catherine Ware lectures in classics at University College Cork and is an expert in Greek and Roman epic, ancient heroism and late antique literature. And her books include Claudian and the Roman Epic Tradition. Dr. Matthew Ward is teaching associate in classics at the University of Cambridge, an expert in the Homeric epic. His PhD was on vehicles of meaning, ships, materiality and the boundaries of the Iliad. And his new project is The Politics of Quotation in Homeric Epic. Dr. George Gazis is associate professor in Greek literature and philosophy at Durham University, an expert on archaic Greek epic and lyric. He is the author of Homer and the Poetics of Hades. Well, you are all very welcome. And Catherine, I might begin with you. This is a hugely complicated book, a complicated story, a complicated central character. So tell us about the Odyssey.
Well, as you say, it's we get the word complicated, certainly in Emily Wilson's translation in the very first line, introducing Odysseus himself. But the story itself is also very complicated. It's not linear. We're not plunged into an epic at the beginning, working our way through to the end. We get somebody else's story first. We get a parallel narrative to Odysseus's homecoming. Then we switch to his son for four books. Then we get to Odysseus. And the bits that we think we know, which are the story about the Cyclops and the Sirens, that's told in his own words in flashback in the middle of the book. So you end up wondering, what do we know? How much is his invention? And of course, he himself is very complicated. He is the man of many ways. He is resourceful. And we have to see him getting in and out of many different difficult situations.
He's a different kind of hero.
To, say, Achilles.
Well, to Achilles or to maybe heroes that we might be more used to on screen that or in stories, and I'll be getting to the film adaptation. But he's a trickster. He finds ways of getting around what he wants to do, including, you know, something that's only mentioned, but the idea of the Trojan horse to win the Trojan War.
Yes. So he is a Trojan hero. He features in the Iliad, where he is. We're presented. We're told about him through, in Helen's words, she's pointing out the various heroes on the field. And King Priam says, who's that fellow? And she says, well, that's Odysseus. He's a great man. And somebody else who's next to her chips in and says, you're absolutely right. And he's a speaker. He doesn't look like much, but when he stands up and the words pour out of him, nobody else can match him. And that's one element that's unusual for heroes generally. Certainly in the Iliad, they fight. So we have Achilles, you know, the strongest, the utterly passionate, aggressive, ready to take offence. He sums up the fighting hero. And then we have, in the Odyssey, you need a very different type of hero, because he is. I think Christopher Brooker describes him as he's the hero who is at sea, quite literally for much of it. But he has to deal with all these challenges. He uses his wits. He speaks again. He can talk his way out of situations. But he also talks himself into them. So we see with the Cyclops, he does that wonderful trick about...
My
name is nobody. And he gets away with it. They escape. And then he's in the boat going away, and the Iliad side of him comes out and going, by the way, Cyclops, if you really want to know who blinded you, my name is Odysseus, the son of Laertes from Ithaca. He gives him his postcode. And then, of course, the Cyclops' father, who's Poseidon, the sea god, targets him.
Matthew, when I heard that Christopher Nolan was making this film adaptation, I wondered why he was making the sequel first and not doing the Iliad first. And researching this, I realised that it isn't actually a sequel and that it's a much more complicated story than that.
Well, I mean, I think that's true. But in some ways, I think you're exactly right, because the Odyssey is always consciously positioning itself as coming after the Iliad. There's much debate, you know, about whether really the poet of the Odyssey knows the Iliad. But one of the things that the poem does is constantly refer back to Troy and to what happened in Troy. So as Catherine's already been saying, I mean, we get these moments where Odysseus takes up his Iliadic identity, where he tries to behave as a fighter in a way that he can no longer in the world of the Odyssey. But as you've already mentioned, I mean, we get... throughout the Odyssey, a large number of stories about Troy and the things that aren't told in the Iliad. So in book 3, we hear from Nestor about how the Achaeans got home again. In book 4, we hear some stories from Helen and Menelaus about what was happening and what Odysseus did at Troy. In some ways, the Odyssey itself is thinking about what it means to come after Troy, about what it means for the race of heroes to now mostly be dead and mostly to have kind of finished their heroic journeys. And that's why, as we go towards the end of the Odyssey, what you see is, precisely as Catherine's been saying, a different mode of heroism. One that relies more on language, that relies more on coming home and returning rather than going out and kind of conquering and fighting.
I can understand now why Christopher Nolan decided to turn it into a film, because it very much suits his style of filmmaking. There are flashbacks. It's not as simple a story as it might first appear. There are twists. There are ways that you can pull the rug from under the feet of the people watching it. So it is very much, I think, a Christopher Nolan type of film.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, as we've been saying, the flashbacks both to Troy and to the adventures from book 9 to 12 all come midway through the epic. I mean, we start in book 1 not with Odysseus. We start with Telemachus. We see the situation on Ithaca. It's not until book 5 that we actually see the hero himself. And then in what follows, we get all these flashbacks and flash forwards. I think one of the ways of thinking about how the Odyssey structures its narrative is that we begin on Ithaca, then we slowly move further and further out in space and time. We go to Sparta, we go into the imaginary world of the adventures, and then all the major players come back together in the second half, and things slowly close down and close down as the tension in the household ratchets up more and more. So I think that will be perfect for the kind of time jumps that we're used to seeing in Nolan films. I mean, one of the things I'll be interested to see, and this is what Catherine's been saying already, is how 9 to 12, how the story of Odysseus's adventures gets told. Because it's clear he's telling that story in the Homer, in the Odyssey. And it's clear that he's inflecting that story in particular ways. So when he arrives at the island of the Cyclops, for example, he says, then we got to the land of the Cyclops. You know, they're lawless, arrogant beings. Well, how does he know that they're lawless, arrogant beings? His retrospective narration is colouring the kind of things that he says. And it'll be interesting to see how Nolan deals with that. Because with film, we're dealing with what we see, perhaps less so than Odysseus's rhetoric. So it'll be interesting to see whether that the truth claims of Odysseus get put under pressure in that moment.
Catherine, Matthew there mentioned Telemachus, the son of Odysseus and Penelope. And there are these crucial characters in it, the son, the wife, Penelope. Is Odysseus the main character, or is this a story where there are multiple kind of main characters?
Good question. The first four books are about Telemachus, the challenge that he's facing on Ithaca. So his father's been away for 20 years, 10 years at Troy, 10 years trying to get home. And they don't know if he's dead or alive. His all these suitors have come to the palace. They want to marry Penelope, and she's holding them off. And he's sitting there. He can't come of age. He's trapped in boyhood. And it's recognised this is difficult for him. But he's sitting there. There's a wonderful scene where he's cross with the suitors. He goes, he more or less sits on a step and sulks. And he's thinking about, wouldn't it be lovely if my father came home and dealt with them? So he has no agency. And it takes the goddess Athena to come and say, go find out what happened to your father, and then become a man. So the first four books we have this happening, that he actually does go and look for information. But he's also given this very, very strong role model, the parallel coming home of Orestes, who is the son of Agamemnon. Agamemnon was the leader of the Greek army. He arrived home and was met by his wife and her lover and was killed. And Orestes then had avenged him. So This parallel is explicitly made, and this model is being forced on Telemachus to some extent. He hears it repeatedly, and so there's always this worry during as the two stories come together, when his father is alive, how is that going to play out? Because it's the Nostos, it's the homecoming. But Agamemnon's homecoming was really, really horrible, and no son wants to kill his mother, I hope. It does work out well, but it is also Telemachus' story, and the two, they come together at the end.
Alexandra, something that Catherine said there struck me. She mentioned the goddess Athena, and that's something that again is maybe showing how this is a story from the ancient world. The idea that you are having gods and goddesses in this story, that there's these different dimensions that are a little unfamiliar to us perhaps in the 21st century.
Yes, so in the Odyssey, we have the goddess Athena, who really helps Odysseus out quite a lot, and she helps Telemachus out quite a lot. So as we said, she shows up on Ithaca and kind of galvanizes Telemachus to go and look for his father. And we then see her helping Odysseus out as he comes home to Ithaca, and she protects him all the while. She changes his appearance so that he can come home, but not really come home, and he can test out the waters. He can see, what are these people like that I left 20 years ago? Is it safe for me to come home, or is it not safe for me to come home? But we also have another god who kind of plays the opposite role to Athena, and that's the god Poseidon, the god of the sea, who does essentially everything in his power to stop Odysseus coming home. And he does this because Odysseus had previously harmed his son, the Cyclops, whose eye he had taken out. He is avenging his son, essentially.
George, can we talk about Hades? And you're an expert on the politics of Hades in the work of Homer. How significant is that in terms of the story?
That's a big question. Thank you. Now, the interesting thing about Hades is that it kind of represents a different realm that runs parallel to the whole action of both the Iliad and the Odyssey. It's the sort of thing that is always there. It's a threat that lies in the background, and you hear about their deaths as well if you're listening to the song. But that means that the legacy is over. The world of the heroes is coming to an end. Everybody slowly is going into Hades, which suddenly becomes a repository of tradition, as it were. So all the stories that you have access to through the Odyssey, you can also have access to if you were able to visit Hades. But of course, by definition, you cannot do that unless you die. And if you die, there's not much point in relaying anything back. Now, the interesting thing that Homer does in the Odyssey is that he manages to get us there, get us down in Hades, get us to get a first-hand experience of the people that we know, we've known for a long time. And we get a chance to hear their voice, at least the first two, Agamemnon and Achilles, after everything has concluded, after the whole quest for glory, all these things that kept us pumped through the Iliad, looking at the heroic brilliance and the excellence in battle. Suddenly we see the aftermath of that, what this actually means in human terms. But the interesting thing about it is, how do you do it? How do you take your audience there when you know that this realm of Hades is inaccessible to everyone? No one can have access, including the gods for the most part, if you exclude Hermes, who is the messenger god, of course. And Homer does it very cleverly by sending Odysseus there. So the story comes from Odysseus' mouth, which creates an interesting paradox. On the one hand, this is a valid source. This is an epic hero telling you their story. But it's a source that's not verified by the poet himself. So the poet at no point claims that this is the narrative that he gets as an inspiration from the gods. In other words, he never verifies the narrative as true. And that creates an incredible ambiguity, because anything that is said in Hades is completely free of judgment. You can say whatever you want. And because it's just a story that comes from a character, it cannot be judged as true or not. It's really left to your discretion. Whereas everything else in the Odyssey and the Iliad cannot be challenged. It comes directly from the Muses. So I think that's the main innovation about the use of Hades, at least in the Odyssey. There's much more to talk about, of course, but it might get too grim.
Well, we'll explore some of those grim elements. Catherine, something that strikes me as well. This is a story that we are all familiar with, even if we have never read it, even if we have never seen a movie adaptation. Because elements of it have entered the popular consciousness, the story of the Cyclops or the idea of the Cyclops or the Sirens. When I was a kid, it was 1985, there was a cartoon on television, Ulysses 31, which was telling the story in the 31st century. It's entered popular culture, and it's entered our civilization's culture in a very powerful way.
Yes, indeed. And this happened very early on. The ancients saw that Homer was the source of all literature, and that Homer, it was interpreted allegorically very early on, so that when Circe turns men into pigs, it's a comment on their real nature. Then later epic writers would look back to Homer and either react against him, but you couldn't ignore him. He had to be there. So things like as George was saying, the importance of this journey to the underworld, that turns up in so many epics onwards and becomes central to things like Dante later on, or Milton,
or James Joyce in Ulysses,
or James Joyce in Ulysses, or Heaney writing. It appears all the time, and the stories themselves, they're just such good stories. And what we find in the Odyssey as well, it's as well as the heroic stories we have, and this isn't my field, but we're into almost into folk myth. These are the stories of the trickster who has to get himself out, who has to use his wits. He can't just... Odysseus will pick up swords and bows and arrows and fight his way out, but primarily he thinks his way through, and he's clever. And that the idea that the smaller person can access these those sort of stories.
Well, tonight we are talking about the Odyssey on the eve of the release of the new Christopher Nolan film. We'll take a quick break now, but when we come back, Homer and the creation of this classic, but also violence and revenge in the story. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are exploring the Odyssey. My brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Alexandra Madewa, postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Classics at Trinity College Dublin and the author of The Argonautica by Orpheus, Writing Pre-Homeric Poetry in Late Antiquity. Dr. Catherine Ware, who lectures in classics at University College Cork and is an expert in Greek and Roman epic, ancient heroism and late antique literature. And her books include Claudian and the Roman Epic Tradition. Dr. Matthew Ward, who's a teaching associate in classics at the University of Cambridge. He's an expert on the Homeric epic, and his PhD was on vehicles of meaning, ships, materiality and the boundaries of the Iliad, and his new project is on the politics of quotation in Homeric epic. And Dr. George Gazis, who's associate professor in Greek literature and philosophy at Durham University. He's an expert on archaic Greek epic and lyric and the works of Homer, and is the author of Homer and the Politics of Hades. Matthew, can we talk about violence and revenge in the Odyssey? Because that features to such a significant degree, and it's probably a more violent text than people might imagine.
Yeah, I think I was thinking, as you were saying just before the break, that the bits that we know about the Odyssey tend to be 9 to 12, the kind of stories, the sirens, the cyclops, Scylla and Charybdis. But within, you know, one of the major focuses of the epic itself is the question of return and its relationship to violence. Now, the problem that the poem has is that by the end, two large groups of men who rely upon Odysseus are dead. So one of the, a family member of the suitors gets up at the end of the poem in the assembly and says, well, look at what Odysseus has done. I mean, on the one hand, he took half, you know, he took all the good young men of Ithaca off to Troy, and he's the only one who's come back. Now, when he got back, he's killed all of the suitors in the palace, plus their attendants. So how are we to deal with a man this violent whose return involves all of this killing? Now, you can extend that problem to Odysseus throughout his adventures too. I mean, we've talked about the blinding of the Cyclops, but there are, you know, you can think about the Lystragonians, his relation to the Phaeacians, all of these ways in which he's quite a traumatic visitor to have come to your island or your house. So the poem, I think, is extremely anxious about this problem of violence and the fact that so many people end up dead in the end. It's really concerned with how we can have a form of reconciliation after that. And it does a couple of things to try to achieve that. So in the beginning, it tells us really, really strongly that Odysseus was trying as hard as he could to save his men. That's explicitly flagged in the poem. And the other thing it does is it paints the suitors as kind of relentless baddies who are sat in the house of Odysseus, eating up the house, eating his food without producing, right? Their burdens on Telemachus, their burdens on Penelope. So it does all of these quite subtle rhetorical moves to try to convince us that what happens to them is okay, that they deserve what they get. But within the poem is obviously, you know, the counter reading that it is Odysseus himself who is this violent visitor. And the poem doesn't quite know how it can explain everything that comes with his return.
And even then at the end, there's the possibility that there would have been more violence and retaliation, only there seems to be a kind of a godlike intervention to kind of make sure the story can end on a somewhat peaceful note.
Yes, I mean, and that's a really striking moment because, as you say, civil war seems to be about to break up on Ithaca, and the gods, you know, Athena and Zeus speak and they say, okay, well, how are we going to make this come to an end? And Zeus says, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll make them all forget. You know, they'll forget the killing of their brothers and their family, and they'll live in harmony and they'll have peace forever. And that sounds really lovely. It sounds nice. You know, the earth will bear fruit and all the good things. But within that, I mean, one of the things the epic is a structure of memory. It's a way, as George has been saying, of remembering all these heroes who've died, remembering their names, remembering their lives. But right at the end of a poem that figures itself as the end of the epic tradition, we get this really strange moment where we say, okay, now let's forget. let's forget everything that's gone before. And I think that too is it's kind of unsatisfactory as an ending, but I think it is for a reason. It's there precisely to make us reflect on whether it would be possible to forget all of the violence that we've experienced and what it would mean to end Epic with forgetting.
Matthew, you mentioned Scylla and Charybdis there earlier, and I studied the 18th century, and in political speeches in the 18th century, politicians often referenced these monsters, that if you were faced with two unpalatable alternatives, it was a reference that was often used and it was a reference that was understood. But it's something that now, if you were to say it in the 21st century, people wouldn't have a clue what you were talking about.
Oh, I don't know if I think that's true. I think you still see it turning up, but perhaps less widespread than once before. But I think that's part of the phenomenon that Catherine has already been outlining, right? That right from, we don't know when the Homeric epics really came about, but right from the beginning, they've been used, reused, and brought into things like speech, drama, other forms of epic, school education, and so on. So I think that's part of that phenomenon where people are always reusing elements of the Iliad and Odyssey that come to stand as shorthand, precisely as you say, for these wider modes of expression. And that tells you something about the lasting influence that Homer's had, I think.
Catherine, can we talk about Penelope? She's going to be played by Anne Hathaway in the film version, and I think that's brilliant casting. But she's such an important figure. So tell me about Penelope having to deal with her husband being absent for 20 years, having to raise her son on her own, and then having to deal with all of these suitors who, as we've heard, are really quite a drain and really kind of a bit of a threat to her because they're all vying to become her next husband.
Yeah, she is an amazing woman, and she is presented as the female equivalent of Odysseus. They're both at one of they're both lion hearted or lion like, and she uses her wits to keep the suitors at a distance. She says, "I can't choose until I have finished spinning the shroud for my father in law," and then unweaves it every night, and. When Odysseus comes back, she is very hesitant to accept him at his word. Even when everybody else goes, "You're definitely Odysseus," she has to test him. And even her son is saying, "You know, you are the hardest hearted of women." And she says, "We have signs by which we'll know." And Odysseus then uses the same words, "You know, how can you be so hard?" And she says, "Fine, look, bring out the bed that you made, have it made up here." And he loses it. She actually gets him at this point because he said, "How can you say that? That bed cannot be moved. I built it's part of an olive tree. I built the room around it." And at that stage, said, "You are my husband." But she, it might be the only time that somebody actually wrongfoots him and tricks him. So she holds it together. We do see her being very upset. There is a parallel. She is weeping for Odysseus at home. He is weeping on the island of Calypso. And we switch from one to the other. So it's as if they maintain this bond over the 20 years. And she has Telemachus, who is a bit of a brat, telling you to just go off to your room, mother, and you'll look after your women. But, you know, he is trying to grow up in his own way. But they are reconciled. And at the end, we see they're telling stories to each other, which is wonderful.
George, I was reading in the book description for Homer and the Poetics of Hades, published by Oxford, that you were born a stone's throw from modern day Ithaca. So I wonder, does that give you any, any additional perspectives? You grew up close to what is modern Ithaca and where so much of this is set?
That's an interesting question. You see, it does in a sense, but not in a positive way. I grew up on an island that half the population claims to be the Homeric Ithaca, even though it's called Cephalonia. The Homeric Ithaca, at least the island that carries the name, you can see it from the seashore. It's very close by. And of course, over there, you have another bunch of people who spend their time and resources trying to prove that Ithaca is the real place. Now, that's the political drama behind it, and it's very important in Greece, of course. People spend a lot of time on that. But on the other hand, if you can remove yourself from this sort of kind of nonsense, to be honest, then you start getting this experience while you're walking around, especially if there are ruins involved, that you're kind of stepping in the same kind of roads that Odysseus must have walked. Of course, none of this has any scientific or scholarly merit whatsoever, but it is a testimony to the power of the story, that it is enough to know the story, to associate it with a place, and try to relive it in said place. And this is not something that I experienced only myself, but rather something that happens to a lot of people if you look around. This tendency of trying to identify the Odyssean haunts, as it were, trying to see in the real map where Odysseus was, what he experienced, all these magical places. And Ithaca, bear in mind, is not one of the magical places, one of the real places. All of these places have seen multiple attempts to be pinpointed on a map, and this is still going on today. As I said, there is a lot of resources going into that. So in a sense, it is inevitable to think about the Odyssey. There's nothing that would stop you from doing that if you are from the area. So I think it's a good starting point for sure, but it can also be very, very confusing trying to read modernity back into antiquity.
Alexandra, it's interesting to hear George there talk about the magical places, because the geography of the Odyssey is such a crucial part of the story as well, because it is a travel adventure in so many ways as well. And how significant do you see the geography in the story?
Well, I think it's a very important part. There's this really big divide between the real places of the Odyssey and the mythical places. So the real places like Ithaca, where Odysseus' home is, or there are other places mentioned, like the city of Troy, where Odysseus came from, Telemachus goes to visit Nestor in Pylos. And then there's this really big contrast between these, what we might call real places, and the places where Odysseus claims to have had all his adventures, like with the Cyclops, or with Circe, or with the Sirens. So scholars tried to locate these places on a real map. So, for example, they tried to locate the Sirens in the Strait of Messina. Eratosthenes is meant to have said, you will find the locations of Odysseus' travels when you find the person who sewed up that bag of the winds. And one more problem with these mythical locations is that, well, Odysseus is the only witness to these places and the things that he claims have happened there. Really, there's always this doubt left in the end about how much of what Odysseus tells us is actually true. So we as modern readers can't really tell in the end, but also ancient readers weren't quite sure about that, argued that, in fact, Odysseus had made all of this up, essentially.
Very interesting. Matthew, this is an oral poem, and it was part of a rich oral tradition over the centuries. And Christopher Nolan in the film apparently has a nod to that by having a poet as one of the characters, and I think played by a rapper, because he wanted to show that that was perhaps the oral tradition in the 21st century. But I think that's a very important part of how the story was remembered and transmitted down the ages.
Yes, I mean, in a sense, you're touching on what is the biggest problem and most debated issue in scholarship on the epics, which is where did they come from and how did we get them now? What we can say, I mean, in truth, we don't know where the Iliad and the Odyssey came from. We're certain, given its repetitive language and its use of repeated scenes, we're certain that these are oral poems, that they in some way came from a genesis over hundreds of years that involved repeated singings. But we have no idea really when they were written down and how they made their way from that first moment where they were written down through the rest of antiquity. But what we can say, I mean, I think in Nolan and elsewhere, what we can say is that throughout the Odyssey, we get a number of singers, which is clearly a way of reflecting on the kind of oral nature of the poem. So in book one, we have a song on Ithaca right from the beginning. We see Phemius the bard. On Scheria, amongst the Phaeacians, we have Demodocus, whom you mentioned earlier, the singer who sings about the Trojan horse and other things. And then we see Phemius again on Ithaca in the later books, where he's one of the few spared from the slaughter of the suitors on the grounds that he is a singer and singers are worthy of respect. So although we don't know where the Odyssey itself came from, we can make some educated guesses, but that's as far as we can go. What we can say is that within the poem is very concerned about the role and the prestige of singers, about what they sing and about who they sing to. So I think having a kind of inset singer within the film is an extremely good idea, and it picks up on one of the major concerns of the Odyssey, which is in a sense storytelling. I mean, I think that's what we've all been saying.
Well, tonight we are talking about that epic storytelling, and we're going to take our final break now, and when we come back we'll be exploring the legacy of the Odyssey. So stay with us here on News Talk.
Ithaca's a kingdom waiting for a king. My dad is coming home.
You're pining for a daddy you didn't even know, like some sniveling bastard.
Ithaca's king is coming back.
Bringing it all.
I could take the throne.
They're not giving up power to you or Odysseus. Do you think life goes back to the way it was?
That world is gone.
If he returned, he'd have to kill him. Like you will.
You gods don't speak in ways we understand.
Who doesn't understand pain? Or blood? The gods told you.
Then I defy the gods.
Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are going in search of the Odyssey. My brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Alexandra Madewa, postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Classics at Trinity College Dublin, and the author of The Argonautica by Orpheus, Writing Pre-Homeric Poetry in Late Antiquity. Dr. Catherine Ware, who lectures in classics at University College Cork and is an expert in Greek and Roman epic, and her books include Claudian and the Roman Epic Tradition. Dr. Matthew Ward, who's a teaching associate in classics at the University of Cambridge and an expert on the Homeric epic, and Dr. George Gazis, associate professor in Greek literature and philosophy at Durham University, who's an expert on archaic Greek epic. Catherine, can we talk about translations of the Odyssey? Because I think so much depends on what version you use and whether it's a very kind of modern retelling of the story with modern language. And the version that Christopher Nolan, I think somewhat controversially, has used is the Emily Wilson recent translation, which turns it into to more immediate modern language. And some people, I think, were critical when they saw the first trailer because the dialogue was too modern for their ears, and they thought it should be something much more archaic sounding. And I think in a way, a lot depends on what version you go to. But I think the strength of the Emily Wilson version is that it is showing that this mightn't have been the language that they were using, but this was the type of words or sentences or constructions that they would have been using in terms of what was popular in their time.
So it is a matter of personal opinion, of what you like, and what you've... partly what you're used to. So when for a long time, I think we used a lot of us of a particular generation would have used Lattimore's translation, which is very, very competent. It's very good, but it's, you know, to modern eyes, it's archaic. And Wilson's is a breath of fresh air in that sense. It's if you've never come to Homer before, it's very, very readable. And what I love about it is I like the translation of Odysseus as a complicated man, which can mean so much, and now also gives us the mental complications. But another thing she does is to put headings for the books. So when you get, say, when he's starting on his journey, it's called a Pirate in the Shepherd's Cave, and you suddenly look back at what Odysseus has been doing since he left Troy. He's plundering other cities. He is a pirate. You know, this isn't necessarily just a good guy, the good hero. So you do get that different perspective on it.
Matthew, it's very much a modern text in the sense that the themes are so relevant and they resonate today. Themes of identity and disguise and whether you can ever truly come home, and about war and violence and the legacy of that violence. That it's set in the past and it was written in the past and it was passed down over the centuries. But the themes that it's dealing with are very much the themes that we are struggling with today.
Yes, I mean, I think that's true. If I could just add on what Catherine was saying as well. I mean, one of the things that's always worth bearing in mind is that no ancient Greek spoke Homeric Greek. It's a completely artificial language that was never used. So one of the challenges in translating Homer is actually capturing the fact that you're dealing with a language that nobody really speaks. So there's some reason to keep a part of the strangeness of the language. When it comes to the themes of the story, I mean, exactly, the Odyssey is interested in disguise, recognition, the relationship between lies and truth, the difficulty of telling a simple story, the problem of coming home. You know, all of these things, as you say, are usable and appropriable in our modern period. Now, the precise configurations of them change, but I think that's precisely why the Odyssey has proved such a rich resource, a rich way of thinking about questions of cultural value, our place in the world, and things like that. It's because at its core, you've got a story that's interested in the process of telling stories, that's interested in whether they're true or not, and that's really interested in how you come back to your family and how you return and are reintegrated within and after moments of traumatic violence. So I think you're exactly right that what that gets you is a set of narrative opportunities that can be used and reused and that always seem to speak in new ways to what our current historical moment is concerned with.
Matthew, what do you see as the legacy of the Odyssey? Because we've described it as storytelling, and it is this great story, this great epic. But why does a story matter thousands of years later? And why should we be spending so much time discussing it and considering it? And why is it so important?
Well, I mean, if I knew the answer to that, I would have written one myself. But I think part of the answer must be it is not just, I mean, it is a poem about all these central themes, but it's also a long history of engagement. You can't read the Odyssey without thinking of Anne Carson or Derek Walcott or James Joyce or Petrarch or, you know, Virgil or Sophocles or whoever. So one of its values is that it is a long history of engagement. I think the other reason I'll give you one reason I now like to think about it and think with it. One of the things the Odyssey seems to me to be increasingly about today is the relationship between overconsumption and limits. So we've talked about how the suitors are sat in the house of Odysseus eating, eating, eating without producing. And increasingly, I think the Odyssey's concern with getting rid of people who consume too much might have something to say to where we're living at the moment.
Alexandra, what would you see as the legacy of the Odyssey? What would you recommend to our listeners in terms of engaging with it? Should they get the Emily Wilson translation?
Well, I have to admit, I am slightly partial to the Lattimore translation that Catherine mentioned. What I really like about it is that, unlike the Emily Wilson translation or others, which are in their own way very good, it really tries to reflect not just the language of Homer, but also the meter of it. So this is a kind of poetry that the Odyssey is written in, the hexameter. And of course, you can't reproduce that exactly in English or another modern language.
But what you can do is kind of capture the rhythm of it a little bit. And I think that's what Lattimore's translation, as archaic as it maybe is, it does it quite well.
George, what would you see in terms of the legacy? And are you looking forward to the release of the Christopher Nolan film? Are you one of those scholars who will be frustrated at what they get wrong and what compromises are made?
It's not my cup of tea. I cannot really transfer these things into modernity. I think the main reason behind it is that we're talking about a text that the sense of antiquity that it always had has been there since the very beginning already. Ancient audiences were listening to Homer. As my colleague said, sometimes they couldn't even fully understand the language because of how archaic it was. And that kind of created a distance that didn't need adaptation for quite some time. Of course, it's always good to experiment, and I'm very happy all this is happening. That's not something that that speaks to me directly. As far as the legacy goes, I would like to add something to the general discussion, because I think one thing we shouldn't overlook is what are the Iliad and the Odyssey really concerned with in reality. So the way I understand it, and of course there are millions of interpretations, it makes sense why that is, but the way I understand it is we're dealing with a version of human beings on steroids, if you like. So everybody is stronger, everybody is better, everybody is more beautiful. It's like a version of yourself that would be absolutely perfect to walk the earth and do whatever they want, except for one thing and one thing only, and that thing is mortality. So we see this whole anxiety of the best version of human beings having to live in the world knowing that they're going to pass away. And of course, everything we see in the Iliad and the Odyssey is kind of a coping mechanism against that. You gain glory, and that gives you a name after death. Or you strive to create the best outcome in life, which is a return to the family home and living out your days, which I might add, Odysseus doesn't do in the end. He just touches ground in Ithaca and then goes away, because Odysseus represents that unstoppable nature of constantly wandering, constantly exploring. I mean, it's not his choice, but still, it's something that speaks into the story. So I think it kind of problematizes the whole concept of human nature, as it were. And this kind of explains the appeal of the text and why it has been so central to our culture and why we find versions of it in other cultures as well, with the trickster and the wanderer and all these sort of ideas that we encounter in the Odyssey. So yeah, when you watch the film or read any sort of translation, just try to keep that in mind, because I think it adds a different perspective as to how it affects us as an audience.
And Matthew, the final word with you. It's also, I think, very interesting that Odysseus himself is a very different kind of hero, and he's a complicated hero, as we've discussed, and at times he's perhaps not quite a hero at all. And there are so many different layers and nuances and dimensions, so many different complications, that also is what we are looking for in the 21st century.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, people have often said that the Iliad was the favorite poem of the kind of, 1800s. But once we reached our modern, postmodern period, the Odyssey, with its complications, with its language, with its lies, became much more important to us as a text that talks about the way we experience and think about the world. I mean, since we're ending, I think George is exactly right to point out that the Odyssey doesn't end. I mean, it comes to an end with the forgetting we mentioned, but built into the text is the prophecy Odysseus has already had that he's going to still keep traveling. He's going to go further and do more. And that also is a kind of resistance to endings that's quite nice and quite suits the way we like to read texts, right? The kind of dot, dot, dot at the end. So we know that the Odyssey is ending, but we also know there are more stories to come, even if we don't get to hear them.
More stories to come, even if we don't get to hear them. And that's, I think, a wonderful and a poetic note on which to end our own discussion tonight. My thanks to my wonderful panel of experts, Dr. Alexandra Madeba, postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Classics at Trinity College Dublin, Dr. Catherine Ware from the Classics Department at University College Cork, Dr. Matthew Ward from Classics in University of Cambridge, and Dr. George Gazis, who's Associate Professor in Greek Literature and Philosophy at Durham University. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marais O'Sullivan, for bringing everything together. We hope you can join us next week for more debate and discussion. We've been talking history. Good night.